Before 9/11, before the Taliban, Afghanistan was famous in the West not for war, but for hand-woven carpets, some of the most beautiful in the world.
Two factors determine the beauty of a carpet. One is the density of its knots. An experienced carpet dealer will count the knots by ear, running his fingernail across the hard ridges on the reverse side of the rug. Designs are plenty, but which design a customer finds attractive is only a matter of taste. True beauty, on the other hand, is indisputable.
Freelance journalist Anna Bodkin had been covering Afghanistan for 10 years when she decided to tell a different story. She went way up into the northern desert to a village called Oka. It's a place so tiny even Google can't find it. Oka is a rug-weaving village, and the people there make carpets saturated with color in geometric patterns that go back for centuries. Just one can sell in the West for tens of thousands of dollars. Very little of that actually makes it back to the village, though. Steve Paulson talks with Anna Bodkin about her book, The World is a Carpet.
Now, one thing that I found fascinating in your description of the making of these carpets is perfection is not actually that highly valued. In fact, one of the signs that these are handmade is that there are flaws in the carpets.
Well, first of all, in the Muslim tradition, perfection, man-made perfection, offends the omnipotence of God. So perfection is not allowed in a carpet. And sometimes a weaver will, on purpose, weave a mistake into her carpet. But that usually is not necessary because a carpet takes on the shape and the life of a weaver because it's woven over a long period of time, between 4 and 9 months. And so there will be a moment when the weaver is distracted because a goat had stumbled into or onto her loom and she has to stand up and chew the goat away. Or, for example, a neighbor came in and started gossiping and the weaver started laughing and forgot the count of thread and had accidentally woven an extra petal into a stylized almond tree, and so on and so forth. So each carpet is unique and becomes the diary of the carpet weaver.
The woman who you focus on, the particular weaver, is named Thaura. What was she like?
Very taciturn young woman in her early 30s. Probably, because most Afghans who are illiterate, and most Afghans are illiterate, very rarely know how old they are. Who wants to count the seasons of privation? Very quiet most of the time, but very open to sex gossip and giggles a lot when somebody comes in and tells her dirty jokes. She is a mother now of 3 children. She is one of the few women in Oka who does not take opium as a palliative because her father-in-law forbids it.
So opium is widespread in this village?
Opium is omnipresent in this village because there is no other way to keep aches and pains at bay. There are no doctors nearby. There are no clinics. There are no pharmacies. So the only thing that you can use when you have a backache and you almost always have a backache if you live in Oka, or a stomachache, you take a little bit of opium. If your child is crying because he's hungry or he's teething, you give him or her a little bit of opium. If you're pregnant and you have a backache and you feel nauseous, you take a little bit of opium. So you're exposing your child to opium prenatally. So basically, it's a village of addicts.
Wow. And also a village that makes extraordinary carpets.
It's a village of people who tell amazing stories. It's a village of people who are extraordinary hosts. It's a village of people who are probably sinners, and some are magnanimous, and some are greedy, and some probably are thieves, and others are something. It's a village that is a sliver of humanity. It's a village of people just like us, just in different circumstances.
How did Thaura learn to make carpets?
She doesn't remember. Her daughter, Leila, who was 5 or 4 years old when I was in the village was already helping her weave. So probably Thaura was 4 or 5 years old when she was helping her mother weave. And her mother probably was 4 or 5 years old when she was helping her mother weave. This is how the craft is passed down.
This is a very poor village, and I think it was at one point in your book you say that the families who make these carpets earn something like 40 cents a day, and it might cost $60 to buy the yarn for one rug, the rug that they're going to make the whole year. And then the scale of all of this starts to go up as these carpets are sold. They might go to a local dealer, but sold for he'll sell them for, what, $200? And then by the time they get to the United States, they sell for thousands of dollars, right?
Carpets for that are exported out of Afghanistan can travel either west to Istanbul or east to Islamabad or Peshawar in Pakistan, or they can fly out of Kabul south to Dubai. And that is where they gain hundreds of percent of their value. And then, of course, when they get from there to, say, Frankfurt or New York or San Francisco or Madison, Wisconsin, they become extraordinarily expensive.
How much are they sold for?
Here in the States, between $5,000 and $20,000 per carpet.
Wow. Which kind of makes you wish that the women who actually make them made more money.
A lot of things make me wish that women who make carpets made more money, not just the price, the exuberant, extortionist price of carpets that people pay for them here, but also the fact that, oh, I wish for these women healthy children who don't die of common cold that goes untreated and then becomes something worse. I wish for these women stomachs that are not so empty. I wish for these women ibuprofen when they have a headache, you know, a warm pair of socks in the winter.
Did you ever feel like you were in a bit of an ethical quandary there? I mean, because I'm guessing that that you could have helped solve some of the financial problems of the family that you were spending all this time with. I mean, you probably could have arranged to have them, you know, sell one of their carpets to a North American dealer for a lot of money. Did you ever consider this?
Okay, so let's say I agreed to help this one family in a village of 240 people, all of whom know me. How do I explain not helping everybody else? How do I then leave and never come back or don't come back for a few years? And what happens to this family? How are they viewed in their community? You know, when I go to – Steve, feeling inadequate is sort of how you normally feel when you work in extremis. I feel extremely inadequate to the pain of the people, to the pain that I witness. And, you know, I console myself by bringing little treats, you know, a couple hundred kilos of rice, some onions. I console myself by saying that by telling stories that I witness, I am contributing somehow to the larger base of knowledge of the people who actually can help, can come and build something, can bring a team of a mobile team of healthcare workers to the village once every 3 months, for example, do things like that. And that's sort of where my job can find an outlet and can find a solution. But it's extremely hard, and it's hard to watch devastation and know that any kind of help you can offer is a Band-Aid.
Yeah. Did you feel like your job was essentially bearing witness? I mean, you were the person giving testimony of how these people are living.
You were saved not in order to live. You have little time. You must give testimony. That's a poem from a poem by Zbigniew Herbert, a Polish poet. That's sort of my lodestar. I guess that's also how I comfort myself when I feel very upset with how little I can do. I'm a storyteller, and I think that the idealist in me believes that somehow my storytelling can make the world a little closer.
Yeah. Could we end with another reading from your book?
I'm going to read from a passage from the end of the book. And what is happening here is my host, who has known me for almost 2 years, refuses to let me stay at his house. At length, Baba Nazar said, "Anna, I know in the past I have invited you to stay, but I don't think you should spend the night here." A deep breath, and suddenly I pictured us the way a bird would see us, a white dove cast off course, or a demoiselle crane perhaps halfway on its hallowed and time and again desecrated migration across the big slate sky. Two people working, a woman carrying food, an importunate visitor, and an old man barefoot in his black galoshes, his glasses held on his head by string, his Soviet shotgun a poor match for the war around him. Five tiny and fragile figures in the sodden desert, a poor man's carpet decocted out of an eternity of violence and generosity and grace. Each of us flawed and so complete. All of us woven into a time warp named Oka.
Anna Badkin's book is called The World is a Carpet, Four Seasons in an Afghan Village. Steve Paulson spoke with her. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.